Matthew 4:1-4:11 was presented by Jack Crabtree on August 9, 2004 at Gutenberg College's Summer Institute, Making Sense of the Bible. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2004. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. The following recording has a brief break in the middle. This is the result of the original 60-minute tape switching to the second side.
Okay, to state the obvious, we don't have time to do justice to this passage. This is an incredibly rich passage, one of my favorite passages in the whole Bible. I just think it's an incredibly rich and powerful thing. Let me start by addressing the question. I mean, that part of what we want to focus on in this week is biblical interpretation and what's it all about and how do you do it and how do you make the decisions that you make and so on. If you'll notice, the interpretation of the temptations that is given by the Grand Inquisitor in Dostoevsky is not a implausible, crazy, irrational, unintelligent interpretation. If you make certain basic assumptions about what Satan's agenda was, what Jesus understood his mission to be, or in this case, what the Grand Inquisitor understood Jesus' mission to be, if you make a certain series of decisions about what I would call the interpretive framework of Matthew 4, a certain cluster of initial assumptions, then your interpretation is going to be made by drawing some intelligent conclusions about how do I need to look at this passage in order to make it coherent with this interpretive framework. On the other hand, I would argue that there's an entirely different interpretive framework that you could apply to Matthew 4 that's very, very different, that's radically different. I'm going to talk about that a little bit in the few minutes that we have. And you make very different decisions about what's going on in the passage because you're trying to make it fit an entirely different interpretive framework. Well, in biblical interpretation, one of the problems we face is, well, how do you decide which interpretive framework to use? And this is going to be frustrating to a lot of you, I know, but the answer I would give to that is, that's what makes biblical interpretation a skill or an art, if you will, rather than a technique. You can't do biblical interpretation by following the rules in a cookbook. You can't program a computer to do biblical interpretation. It takes a human being to do biblical interpretation. And what I mean by that is, it takes a human being who, over the course of time and experience, teaches himself or herself the skill of being able to grasp what is in fact what I will call the intrinsic interpretive framework of a passage. And what I mean by the intrinsic interpretive framework is, what's the interpretive framework that the actual author of that passage had in mind that you would use, that you would apply to the passage, as opposed to something alien, foreign, that you're imposing from outside. And that's our goal, that's our task as interpreters, is to try to, and I'm choosing my language carefully, to get in touch with the intrinsic interpretive framework of a passage. And how do you know when you've done that? You just do. And I know how frustrating that is, but that's the nature of all skill and all art, is that capability of human rationally to know what you know tacitly without being able to tell someone else or yourself, articulate to yourself, what it is you know when you know it. One of the books that we read in the Gutenberg curriculum is a book called Personal Knowledge by Michael Polanyi. It was a very, very, very helpful book to me in my understanding rationality and reason and knowledge and epistemology. And he makes an important distinction between what he calls tacit knowledge and articulate knowledge. Tacit knowledge is stuff that you know, but you are unable to give expression to what it is that you know. You can't articulate to someone you know. You can't even articulate to yourself. but you clearly know it. He uses the example of a 10-year-old boy riding a bicycle. That 10-year-old boy riding a bicycle clearly knows how to ride a bicycle because he's doing it. He clearly knows something that is allowing him to keep his balance and propel himself down the street. But he couldn't stand up here and give you a lecture on the principles of angular momentum and all of the physics of bicycle riding. He can't articulate to you what he feels as he's keeping his balance on the bicycle. And what he feels is he knows it. He knows what he needs to do with his muscles, with his body, with the angular momentum of the keeping the balance on the bicycle. He knows all that stuff. But he doesn't know what it is that he knows. That is, he is not able to articulate to anyone else, including himself, what it is that he knows when he knows what it is. Well, Polanyi goes on to point out that any art is like that. Any connoisseurship is like that. Any skill is like that. Is that it's at the tacit level of human understanding. He uses the example of teaching a doctor, a surgeon, how to know whether a heart is healthy or not. To learn whether, when you listen through a stethoscope, whether a heart is healthy, you don't go to lectures. You don't have someone stand up there and lecture you on what a healthy heart sounds like. You have someone put a stethoscope on somebody's chest and you listen to it, and the master who's coaching you says, now there, that's a good heart. You figure out what it is that you are hearing that tells you that that's a good heart. You need to teach yourself. He doesn't say that, but that's implicit in what's going on. Nobody can teach that to you. You have to teach yourself. And I'm arguing that biblical interpretation is an art in that same sense. No one can teach you when you have rightly chosen that that's the intrinsic interpretive framework rather than this other thing. In making that decision, and in making that decision rightly, there's probably hundreds of things you've noticed, hundreds of things you know, and most of those you don't even know that you know them. But they have gone into indicating to you, that's what's going on. And if you've had much experience with, and this is not just biblical interpretation, I'm talking about any interpretation of any language, of any text, anywhere, it's the same phenomenon, but if you've had much experience with that, you know that moment as you're struggling with a text and you can't figure out what's going on and you don't know what on earth are they trying to say, and all of a sudden you just notice something that puts pieces together and it's like the light goes on. You know, there's that intuitive click. Oh, I see what he's doing. Sometimes you almost say that out loud. Oh, I get it. That's what you need to train yourself in biblical interpretation. Is stay with the text, fight the text, worry about the text, sleep on the text long enough until somehow your mind puts the pieces together and you go, oh, okay, that's it. Now, why are we going that's it? Because all those unsolved, disconnected fragments of information and clues that I have been worrying about, even though I can't even articulate what all of them are all of a sudden answered in one fell swoop, because I've hit the intrinsic interpretive framework that answers them all. So I would argue that the Grand Inquisitor has the wrong interpretive framework for the temptations and has imposed that on this passage. I'm not even sure I can fully understand or articulate his interpretive framework, but you begin to clearly see the difference when you recognize that the Grand Inquisitor is emphasizing Jesus' role as king, as ruler, as savior of the world, as the one to solve all the problems of the world, to bring mankind to happiness, and so on and so forth. And everything in the way the Grand Inquisitor is looking at these things is assuming that Jesus' decisions, one way or the other, is about how he's going to accomplish that and how he's going to play out that role as savior, ruler, king, so on and so forth. I would argue that the correct and valid interpretive framework is to see an individual human being before his God. And in that regard, therefore, what Jesus is doing here in the way he's confronting these temptations is completely and totally an exemplar for how we should interact with temptations. This is not Jesus in his unique role that we're seeing. Satan uses that as part of his deception and his strategy, granted. But what he's appealing to in Jesus is universal. Our universal human longings, universal human needs, universal human fears and doubts and insecurities and so on. We experience all the same things that Satan is trying to probe at in Jesus. And when Jesus responds to them then, he's responding the way a human being ought to respond in exactly that sort of situation. Okay, just in the 15 minutes that we have here then, let me just briefly try to give you an interpretation. Not everyone on staff would agree with everything I'm going to say here. I'm sure you won't agree with everything I'm going to say here, but let me tell you how I look at these temptations at this point in my career. In the first temptation, the need, of course, is just simple, plain old human physical desire, physical need even, if it's hunger. And Satan is coming to him and he says, if you are the Son of God, turn these stones into bread. Now, one of the first questions we face is, what does he mean by if you are the Son of God? How are we to take that? Is he challenging Jesus' identity as the Son of God? I don't think so. I think Satan knows good and well that Jesus has just heard the voice come out of heaven at his baptism saying, this is my beloved Son in whom I'm well pleased. That's an established empirical fact as far as Jesus is concerned, and Satan knows that. He's not calling that into question. He's wanting to exploit that fact. The thing we need to recognize is to put together if you are the Son of God with the circumstances that Jesus has found himself in. Namely, he's been led by the Spirit into the wilderness, and lo and behold, God has led him out into the wilderness but hasn't managed to supply any food to him. He's let him go hungry, perhaps to the point of starvation. Well, Satan is trying to suggest to Jesus the incredible incongruity between being the Son of God and being treated the way his Father is treating him. You're the Son of God, and lo and behold, your Father has not cared for you. Bummer. I wonder what kind of God he might be that he wouldn't. I mean, you're not just any old ordinary peon, any old schmuck. You are the Son of God. Well, if you are the Son of God and God has treated you this way, implicitly, what does that say about God? He's saying, trying to drive a wedge between Jesus and God, the wedge of doubt, the wedge of mistrust between them. And then he's making a suggestion, if God is not going to take care of even you, the Son of God, then perhaps you better take care of yourself. And to take care of himself is to step outside of the will of God, to step outside of what God has decreed, what God has ordained, and go his own way, write his own script for his own story, instead of allowing God to be the one scripting his story. And that then is what Jesus responds to, I think, by saying, no, wait a minute. The focus of my life, I think that's what he means when he quotes Deuteronomy by man shall not live. I would paraphrase live as focus your life upon. Man shall not focus his life on bread alone, on merely getting his physical needs met. The focus of man's life needs to be, as he puts it, every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. Now, that's a very vague and ambiguous phrase, but I think what that means, as best I understand it, is he's using the words proceeding out of the mouth of God to basically be an image of God as the one who says, let there be light, and there is light. God is the one who speaks into existence every detail of human history. What comes to be because God has said, let it be, in effect. So every word that comes that proceeds out of the mouth of God is basically a way of describing the will of God, the sovereign providential will of God. So what Jesus is saying is what Moses understood that God was trying to teach Israel is that the focus of our life should be to have my life play out that which God has decreed for me. rather than getting my physical needs met. To have the focus of my life be on getting my physical needs left would ultimately be subhuman. I was made for something different than that, other than that, better than that, greater than that. Any animal can get his needs met. That there's nothing particularly spectacular about that. But to be a character in a complex playing out of a drama being told by the creator of all reality, that's something special. And that should be the focus of our life. That should be the substance of what my life is all about. And so in effect, what Jesus is saying is, I'd rather have God's will for me play out than me simply not be hungry any longer. If me having God's will played out means going hungry, then so be it. But that's what my life is about. So that's what I'm going to do. Second temptation, let's see, in Matthew it's the pinnacle. Okay. He's taken to this point on the temple where if they have rightly identified what it's literally in Greek, the wing of the temple, if they've rightly identified what the wing of the temple is, it's probably a 600, 700 foot drop to the bottom of the valley. So you'd be jumping to his death unless God were to send his angels to bear him up. The key, I think, to understanding this is to realize that the parallel with the Deuteronomy account that he refers to when he quotes Deuteronomy, you shall not put the Lord your God to the test. That's a reference to the Exodus event where Israel is led out of Egypt into the wilderness and they are without water and they quarrel with Moses about their situation. Moses, why have you brought us out here to die of thirst in the wilderness? And Moses goes to God and God tells him what to do to perform this miracle to turn this poisonous water into drinkable water. And that happens. And then later in Deuteronomy, Moses is saying, now don't you dare test the Lord like you did at Meribah and Matzah. That's a reference to that event in Exodus where in the Exodus account, Moses says, why are you testing the Lord, how's he put it, to see whether he is among us, something like that, to know whether he is among us, something like that. Basically, what Moses is recognizing is, I mean, we have to get some perspective on this. There have never been a string of miracles pulling back the curtain to allow human beings to see the reality of God more spectacular than what was done in the Exodus. I mean, this is the time in history where God ripped back the curtain and poked his head out and said, I'm here. It's just, I mean, this was a big demonstration of the reality of God. This happened, what, months, I guess, before this event. Maybe even days, I can't remember. But a short time before this. And here they are in the wilderness, having had the reality of God, his faithfulness to them, his commitment to them. He told them, I'm taking you to the land that I promised your father to give to you, and you will be my people and I will be your God. And he's told them what his program is and what his project is. Nothing could be clearer. And here they are a few days later saying, I wonder if God is for us or against us. And Moses is going, who are you guys? What's with this? Don't be doing that, he's saying. Don't test the Lord like you did at Meribah and Matzah. Don't be so obtuse. Don't be so hard-hearted. Don't be so blind. Don't be so ignorant that all the evidence that God has given you counts for nothing. Believe the evidence that's been given to you, even when life gets a little hard, even when the journey gets a little rough. Know that what's in your past, what commitment God has made to you, what reality he has shown to you, and count on that. So somehow Jesus recognizes that what Satan is asking him to do parallels what was happening in the Exodus account. And I think what Jesus is recognizing here, and here you really see the wisdom, the discernment, the insight, the self-knowledge, if you will, of Jesus. Jesus is simply asking himself the question, why would I jump? Ostensibly, Satan is saying, I think, Well, so that you can prove your devotion to God, so that you can prove your trust in God. You can demonstrate to God how much you believe in Him, how much you honor Him, how much you're devoted to Him. So ostensibly, it's to do this incredible, noble act of faith. But Jesus is saying, well, and why would I do that? Oh, I would do that if I wondered whether God really accepted me, whether God really approved of me, whether I was really in good standing with God. That's why, that would be the real reason that I would have to perform a spectacular act of faith for God. It wouldn't be for God, it would be for me to deal with some insecurities that I have about where I stand. And then he hearkens back to this commandment in Deuteronomy, which is hearkening back to Exodus and going, that would be evil. God, I just had a voice come out of heaven a few days ago saying, this is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased. Has that changed? Nothing's changed. I don't need God to prove to me any longer, beyond any more, above and beyond that, what He's already told me. I simply need to rest and accept what He's already demonstrated, what He's already proven, what He's already claimed, and live with that. You know all the stories about people throwing away their insulin out of faith because they want to prove to God that they believe in His word and that He will heal them of insulin, I mean, of diabetes, and then they die or go into a coma or something like that. Well, we all recognize the impulse to do that. But Jesus rightly, I think, identifies. I mean, every time I've actually seen that happen with people, it's their insecurity that's driving them. They want to know. They want God to do something spectacular for them so that they can know that they are approved by God and acceptable to God. It's really not going the other direction. And that's what Jesus has so astutely recognized. There'd be no reason to do that except my unbelief or my doubt. And I don't really have any reason to doubt. So that would be wrong. And then finally, the last one is where Satan comes and says, just bow down to me and I'll give you all the kingdoms of the world. At this point in time, I think that what he means by all the kingdoms of the world is basically the known civilized world of that day, the Roman Empire, which at this time was pretty big, close to its apex. And he puts him on a high mountain just so he can get a visual experience of the vastness of the numbers of people and the amount of land and what we're talking about here. And he's saying, I'll give you all that. It's mine now. And I think he's not altogether wrong about that. Satan is described as the prince of the air, or prince of the something in Ephesians. I mean, he is given some kind of authority. And for him to say, I'll give it all to you, is to a certain extent a bona fide offer. I don't think it's really a bona fide offer, but in a sense it is. And the question in this temptation is, what is he actually asking Jesus to do? I think my best reading on this is that what he's asking him to do is to simply bow and scrape for a couple of seconds here. That is, that's what makes the temptation a temptation. I mean, it wouldn't make any sense for him to say, if you worship me like God, like as if I were your God for the rest of your life, I'll give you all the kingdoms of the earth. I mean, even I could probably resist that temptation, especially if he had his pitchfork with him. But I think what makes this subtle, what makes this insidious and difficult and compelling, is he's saying, look, all you have to do is just bow down, put your forehead on the ground for just 10 seconds, and you don't even need to mean it. Just this little token act of obeisance to me for just a second, and I'll declare you the winner, and I'll go away, and you can be king. Well, you know, what would be compelling about that is, I believe Jesus has enough awareness of his destiny that he knows that what's in store for him is death on the cross. Even if he doesn't know that what's ahead is death on the cross, he knows that his Father is going to call upon him to suffer because he's just been doing that for these 40 days and 40 nights. It has not been an easy road being in the will of his Father. So you have Satan over here saying, your destiny is to be King of Kings and Lord of Lords over the whole, all of creation and the whole earth. Well, I'll give you everything I got, at least as a starter, I'll give that to you. And unlike your Father, who makes you suffer in order to enter into your destiny, all you have to do for me is, you know, humble yourself for 3 seconds. Just give me a thrill for a second. That's all I'm asking. Which in effect is saying, what Satan is basically trying to suggest is, I'm better than God. I'm a gooder dude than God is, because I don't make people suffer in order to bless them with the blessings that I'm willing to bless them with. Again, trying to drive that wedge between Jesus and the goodness of God, the goodness of his Father. And that's why Jesus, I think, rightly responds with what he responds with. It is written, you shall serve the Lord your God and him only, something like that. You shall worship the Lord your God and serve him only. He's not saying, I think, the passage says, don't throw us up to Satan when you don't mean it. Don't even throw us up to Satan when you don't mean it. That's not what the verse is saying. Jesus, again, is astute. He's recognizing, you're saying all I have to do is bow and scrape for a few seconds, but I'd be making you the benefactor. You would be my benefactor if I were to do that. And I'm not to do that. I am to allow my Creator, the author of my being, to be the one who gives me the blessings in my life. You would be my God if you were my benefactor, and there's only one God that counts. So no, I'm not going to do that. So again, he's recognizing that behind the ostensible request of Satan is something far more insidious, far more subtle than what it appears on the surface. And I've kept you a little bit over time. I know you'll have questions. We'll have time this afternoon. So.